In our last message, we noted that the book of Judges has two introductions. We've looked at the first that's found in Judges 1:1 through 2:5, and we're partway through the second, which we will finish tonight, goes from Judges 2:6 to 3:6. While the first introduction looked back in Israel's history to show the backdrop to this time period, the second introduction provides a summary preview of what is going to be narrated in greater detail throughout the book. In this way, it gives us a big picture of what to expect and some keys to interpret the details of the book. This second introduction began with a picture of Israel's unfaithfulness to the Lord after the death of Joshua. We can expect to read in this book about Israel forsaking Yahweh and worshiping false gods like the Baals. One of the reasons for this will be Israel's failure to inculcate the rising generation in the faith of their fathers. Every generation of believers is charged with raising their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And one lesson we see in Judges is what happens when this responsibility is neglected on a grand scale. So let's refresh our memory about Yahweh's response to Israel's unfaithfulness as we find it in the verses just before our passage. Let me read Judges 2:14 and 15. The anger of Yahweh was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of Yahweh was against them for calamity, as Yahweh had said, and as Yahweh had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. As we noted last time, the Lord of the covenant is faithful both in his covenant blessings, but also in his covenant cursings. And we will see both in the book of Judges. Our passage tonight will highlight the Lord's grace toward Israel, as well as his chastisement that comes when Israel departs from his ways. And we'll have a three-part outline. First of all, we're going to look at Yahweh's gracious provision of judges in verses 16 through 19. Yahweh's gracious provision of judges. Then Yahweh's testing of Israel in verses 20 through 23. And finally, the nations of testing in chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. So tonight we're going to conclude our study of this second introduction to judges. And we begin with Yahweh's gracious provision of judges. Now, I've already read verses 14 through 15, which describe Yahweh's anger against Israel and his acts of delivering them into the hands of their enemies. If the narrative ended there, it would be most discouraging. But the good news is that it doesn't. Indeed, the first word of verse 16 is a word of grace. It's the word nevertheless. Verse 16, nevertheless, Yahweh raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. When I looked up nevertheless in an English dictionary, I found the main definition is in spite of that. So in the context of verse 16, it means in spite of the fact that Israel forsook the Lord repeatedly and served false gods, in spite of that, something is going to happen. Now, we know such deeds deserve judgment, and verses 14 through 15 record divine judgment, but that is not the end of the story, because while sometimes giving Israel what she deserves in her sin, Yahweh also sometimes blesses her in ways she does not deserve. And that is why the word nevertheless is a word of grace in verse 16. In spite of Israel's repeated failures and unfaithfulness, Yahweh raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And once again, we see the sovereignty of the Lord on display. According to verse 14, Yahweh delivered them into the hands of plunderers. And here in 16, Yahweh delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered him. Now, there's no contradiction here. Yahweh controls all nations, and he can choose to temper justice with mercy according to his sovereign will. He can give his people over to their enemies, and then he can rescue them from their enemies. Now, you would think such mercy would humble Israel and lead them to faith and obedience to the Lord, but that is not what happens. Verse 17, yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of Yahweh. They did not do so. So Yahweh graciously gave Israel judges they did not deserve to lead them in paths of righteousness, and their response is they would not listen to them. Rather, we're told they played the harlot with other gods. Just as the New Testament reveals the church to be the bride of Christ, so the Old Testament in many places portrays Israel as the wife of God. When she plays the harlot with other gods, she commits spiritual adultery. And the image is a powerful one if we would but reflect on it. False worship is like sleeping with someone other than your spouse. It is the ultimate betrayal. And that is especially the case when the one betrayed is God Almighty. But you see, that is just what Israel did. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of Yahweh. They did not do so. And notice how they turned. They turned quickly. They really didn't take much heed to what the judges were teaching them about the ways of righteousness. They quickly turned from those good ways. Sin had a greater pull on them than did holiness. And it didn't take much time at all for them to turn aside from the call to obey the Lord. Verse 18, "And when Yahweh raised up judges for them, Yahweh was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For Yahweh was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them." When the Lord graciously raised up judges for Israel, he would use that judge to deliver them from their enemies. They actually had some temporal deliverance. Well, why would he do this? We're told Yahweh was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And commentator Ralph Davis notes, this groaning connotes misery rather than repentance. It is not that they called out in faith to the Lord. It's simply that they are groaning in their misery, and in his compassion, the Lord acts. Davis goes on to point out the special significance of the word. The groaning of verse 18 is a noun used only three times in the Old Testament, two of which are in Exodus. There, the groaning is that of Israel under Egyptian slavery, a groaning that God hears, and he remembers his covenant and delivers them. The very word in Judges 2:18 should carry our minds back to Exodus. So when we read that Yahweh was sorry on account of their groaning, it is as if the text is saying, see, Yahweh is still the same in 1100 B.C. as in 1400 B.C. His mercies never come to an end. Hundreds of years do not cool the warmth of his compassions. And we could add that what was true of hundreds of years is true of thousands of years down to our own day. God is still compassionate toward his people, even when we fail him. And this principle finds new covenant expression in 2 Timothy 2:13. If we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. Of course, that doesn't give us license to sin. It doesn't say there's never the possibility of apostasy, but it is a glorious gospel truth that we trust in God's faithfulness and not our own. For Israel, though, the positive impact of judges turned out to end each time that judge died. Verse 19, "And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way." Israel's behavior here is a bit like that of school children. When the teacher's in the room, they put on their best face, they act on good behavior. But once the teacher leaves the room, mayhem prevails. And you see, then, what they really want to be doing. And each time a righteous judge died, Israel showed what she really wanted to be doing, which was worshiping false gods. Note it says, they did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn way. And that's really always the choice. We will either obey God or we will make ourselves God and do what we want to do. And that's what Israel was doing. Well, that brings us to our second point, which is Yahweh's testing of Israel. Listen now to verses 20 through 23. Then the anger of Yahweh was hot against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of Yahweh to walk in them, as their fathers kept them, or not. Therefore Yahweh left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Joshua. Now you may recall when we went through the book of Joshua that Israel sinned when she did not completely drive the pagan nations out of the land. And Joshua had warned them against assimilating with these people. Near the end of his life, Joshua said, take careful heed to yourselves that you love Yahweh your God, or else, if indeed you go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go into them, and they to you, know for certain that Yahweh your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you. But they will be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which Yahweh your God has given you. Joshua had warned that if Israel compromised spiritually with these nations, then know for certain that Yahweh your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you. And here in Judges 2, we learn that Israel does fail. And Yahweh responds, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. But there is divine purpose at work. For it continues, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of Yahweh to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. So Yahweh will use some of these nations left in the land to test Israel. And what is the test? Will they follow the ways of the Lord, or will they follow the ways of the Canaanites and the other ites that were still living in the land? And note, we're told that this is one of the reasons the Lord allowed them to remain. We read, therefore Yahweh left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Joshua. He knew Israel would be unfaithful, and that he would then use these remaining peoples to test Israel's loyalty. Even here, we may note God's grace, for instead of destroying Israel, he disciplines them. And that brings us to, thirdly, the nations of testing in chapter 3, 1 through 6. When we enter chapter 3, we learn more details about those from the nations who had been left behind in the land. Now these are the nations which Yahweh left that he might test Israel by them. That is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it, namely, five lords of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites, who dwelt in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon to the entrance of Hamath. And they were left that he might test Israel by them, to know whether they would obey the commandments of Yahweh, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So three times in the verses we read previously and in these verses, we hear the statement that Yahweh is going to test Israel, test Israel, test Israel. But here we know another reason why Yahweh allowed some from the nations to remain in the land. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formally known it. Now, some commentators are embarrassed by the statement that the training for war was the only reason involved. After all, we just read that the reason was to test Israel. Well, I think one commentator has a helpful explanation. He says, the way to reconcile this apparent contradiction is to examine what is meant by training Israel in the ways of war. In the first place, Israel had to learn that there was a war, and that peace and compromise with Canaanites is impossible. In the second place, Israel had to learn how to fight the wars of the Lord. This does not mean military tactics, though such are not completely excluded, but rather means prayer and faith. The wars of the Lord are fought by faith and prayer. And if you can picture, you know, after the Exodus, the battle against the Amalekites, and Moses there with his arms lifted in prayer. And as long as his arms were lifted, Israel prevailed. Israel will prevail, not by their own military strategies, but by their faith in the Lord. But a new generation is rising in Israel. They had not known the battles by which their fathers had taken the land. They had not fought in them. And they had grown accustomed to the presence of some of the pagan nations remaining among them. They were tempted to do what we're often tempted to do, to go along, to get along with these people of other religions, maybe even being open-minded to what those religions taught. And you know, some of the Israelite guys thought some of the Canaanite girls looked pretty cute. This generation that was rising up needed to know that serving Yahweh meant being at war with false gods and false religions. And they needed to know that this meant more than military might. It meant, first of all, depending upon God and in faith and prayer, discerning how they were to deal with such challenges. If Yahweh sent them into battle, he would get the victory and all glory would go to him. Well, how well do they submit to Yahweh's discipline and Yahweh's program? Verses 5 through 6. Thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. What do? They do exactly what Joshua had warned against, exactly what Yahweh had condemned. They intermarried. And this is spiritual intermarriage. This is compromising the worship of the one true God and going to serve other gods, false gods. And what this second introduction tells us is that we can expect to read about a lot of sin in the book of Judges. But then finally, verses 5 through 6, thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. I'd read that before, but they took their daughters to be their wives. Okay, I already did that. Conclusion. Now, I've already read, I've drawn some attention to what I called the beauty of that gospel nevertheless back in chapter 2:16. That first word in our passage that points to God's grace, that is grace, because it comes to us in spite of what our sin deserves. That's what makes it grace. And throughout this book of the Bible, God shows his grace to Israel by his repeated gift of righteous judges despite their ongoing sin. And this is but a faint foreshadowing of the Father's gift of his Son, who loved us despite our sin and died to deliver us from our sin. If you look for it, you will find intimations of the gospel throughout the Old Testament, including in this book of Judges. What I want to close with is one other application that's rooted in that parenthetical comment in chapter 3, verse 2. This was only so that the generations of the children might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it. I fear we live in a time when the rising Christian generation, in large part, does not realize that we are at war. Now, we don't literally have Canaanites living among us, but we are bombarded with the philosophies and the temptations of Canaan every day. You will hear many messages from your phone, your keyboard, your television, your magazines, and your friends and acquaintances. And many of these messages are variations on one theme. You don't need to serve the Lord alone. There is so much fun to be had if you'll just compromise a little bit with your religion. A church that has grown accustomed to the world needs to be reminded that we are called to be at war with the world. Indeed, a spiritual battle is raging. And if we're not aware of it, and if we're not engaged in it, we may already be wartime casualties. We need to be absolutely convinced that peace and compromise with the Canaanites is still impossible. Now, the enemy takes many forms. But the Apostle Paul reminds us of the enemy behind our enemies. Ephesians 6, 10 through 12. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Brothers and sisters, we will be tempted every day to betray our Savior in order to follow the ways of the world. And the temptation to do so comes from the devil and his minions with whom we are called to do battle. So let us learn from the mistakes of Israel and heed the apostles' admonition. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand.